The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've got a lot to get to on this last day of the week, the last program of the work week. Friday is already here. A busy weekend ahead as well. But as I said the other day, we're back into school. School is in session for the academy and for the college. And so lots going on. I mentioned on yesterday's program that we were heading down to London for the evening to see Melanie Phillips, who writes for the Times of London and for the Jerusalem Post. She sends out an email newsletter as well. Quite a lot going on. She appears on Question Time, I think is what they call it here in the UK. Quite controversial, she is. Oftentimes she's on a panel where everyone on the panel and in the crowd is very much against her and her opinions. So she's definitely known to speak her mind, and she certainly doesn't just go along with the flow. That's for sure. Anyhow, four of us went down. It was actually an interesting trip. On the train, we returned a lost phone to its owner, and then one of us ended up losing our phone. It wasn't me. I won't say who it was, but it was left on the train, so that made for some frantic phone calls. And anyway, as it turns out this morning, that lost property was returned, so it was a good ending to a dramatic and traumatic experience last night, late at night. But before that, again, just a wonderful evening at a synagogue called St. John's Wood Synagogue, of all names, to have for a Jewish synagogue. You've got St. John's in the name, and a fairly big synagogue right in the heart of London. And it looked as though there were maybe 200-300 people there to listen to Melanie Phillips. We were able to meet her, by the way, going in before the event, as she was signing some of the books there that she was selling to the public. And we told her about Armstrong Auditorium. I mentioned my father, who spent quite a lot of time with her about a year ago when she visited the campus. And she stood up and smiled and told me to relay to the people back at headquarters just how wonderful that experience was, and how generous and hospitable everyone in Edmond were during that visit. So some good feedback there from the honored guest of the event last night. And she and so many of the others there, most of them were Jewish, they gathered there on Holocaust Remembrance Day. I talked about this some yesterday. Just the general ignorance there is in education today, where you've got something like 2/3 of millennials that don't even know, they don't even know anything about Auschwitz. I mean, this is not even a century old, and we have these remembrance days every year, and yet it says a lot about education today when young people, and even many of our adults, sadly, they don't know anything about the death camps. They don't know much about World War II. They don't know much about Adolf Hitler. They just use it, well, really to call someone a bad name today. If he's someone that you disagree with, he's a Nazi or he's Hitler. But there's so much ignorance when it comes to the actual history and what led up to that world war. 6 million Jews slaughtered during World War II, and yet so many people are ignorant of this history, and we see the history repeating itself, as I discussed with you yesterday. You see this sharp increase in violence and persecution aimed at Jews in the Middle East, in Europe, right here in Britain. I mean, the question that Melanie was there to answer last night was, is it time for Jews to leave Israel? Or rather, is it time for them to leave Europe for Israel? Is it time for them to leave the UK? I'll just cut to the chase here and give you one of the latter clips from her speech last night. She went on for about an hour. Richard, by the way, arranged for me to use 24 clips today. I'm not going to quite get through all 24, I just told Jonathan. But we do have some highlights here from her presentation last night. And the people there at the synagogue were nice enough to let us record the speech. But here she is toward the end of her presentation. This is clip 21.
So, to the question you all want me to answer, is it time to leave? It's very personal, and I wouldn't presume to advise anyone what to do. I can only speak for myself and say that for some years now, I've been spending a very great deal of my time in Israel. Because even with 150,000 Hezbollah rockets pointing at us from Lebanon, even with Hamas trying to every day to murder us, and with Iran working towards its genocide bomb to wipe us out, Israel is where I feel so much safer and where the air is so much sweeter. And it's where Jews are not on their knees and where no one will ever make me feel I am not entitled to live there and don't properly belong. Israel is where we have astonishingly renewed ourselves as a nation out of the ashes of the Shoah. Israel is where all those who want us gone meet their nemesis in the political realization of the eternal people. Israel is the ultimate and ultimately the only definitive and triumphant repudiation of antisemitism and the true vindication of the millions of us who perished in the unspeakable events that we memorialize today.
That's Melanie Phillips from her presentation last night at St. John's Wood Synagogue in London. It's a very personal thing to consider whether or not to move. Aliyah is what they call it when you uproot from your place in France or in the UK or the United States and move to Israel. And she's spending more and more time in Israel. It's kind of funny. One of our diggers, our excavators, just saw her on the highway about a week ago as he was making his way back to the UK. He passed her in the car. Brent Nachtigall's run into her a couple of times in Israel. It's a small world. It seems like she's been to Armstrong Auditorium in Edmond. We've seen her now down in London, and a few of our excavators have seen her in Israel as well. We keep bumping into her. And her personal preference, more and more, is that she wants to be in Israel. Even though they've got all these rockets aimed at them, even though Hamas, terrorists, jihadis, are trying to kill Jews, kill Israeli soldiers, it's Israel's land, and she feels safe there. She, as a Jew, she feels safe in Israel. Is she just an alarmist? If her preference is that people should move, is it time to leave? Is it time to go to Israel? Well, of course, we know from Bible prophecy that it's not going to be safe for Israelites, not just Jews. It's not going to be safe for Israelites in Judah, in the UK, in the United States. But in looking at what's happening, I mean, from her perspective, when you just consider what's happening in Europe and the UK even, you can see why she and others are sounding the alarm. She wrote in the Jerusalem Post this week, by the way. Some of this was brought out in her speech last night. But in the JP, she says, "Anti-Semitism in Europe has become mainstream and normalized at a level not seen since the Second World War." We touched on this yesterday. Quoting from that, the president of the European Jewish Congress. "We haven't seen it like this since World War II. We better wake up." The article says it's as if a veil lowered after the Holocaust has now been lifted to reveal that little has changed. Have we learned the lesson of history? Or is history repeating itself? She says those who deny their anti-Semitism are doomed to repeat it. History is repeating itself. And so you see this alarming escalation in violence aimed at Jews in Sweden, in Germany, in the Netherlands, in France, in the UK. Breitbart said yesterday, I quoted from this article on yesterday's program, that there's been a 34% increase in anti-Semitic physical assaults in Britain just last year, 34%. She said in her presentation last night, she's quoting from some organization that started keeping track in 1984, and we're seeing the highest level of violence aimed at Jews since that organization started keeping track of it in 84. So some 30 years, 30 plus years. And of course, here in the UK, there's been quite a lot of news of late about Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party and just how involved they are in so many different anti-Semitic organizations, Facebook pages and such. It's turning out to be quite scandalous. As you see how that the Labour Party right here in the UK, I mean, it's right in bed with all of these groups that hate Jews. And of course, who can forget what Jeremy Corbyn said years ago about his friends in Hezbollah, his friends in Hamas. Just a few weeks back, you had this 85-year-old survivor of the Holocaust, an old woman in a wheelchair, stabbed to death, and her body was burned by a young Muslim, a young man that, as Melanie Phillips pointed out last night, this 85-year-old woman had known since he was a little boy. She knew him when he was a little toddler, and he grew up and murdered her. This is not unusual. These kinds of incidents are popping up all over the continent, all over Europe. Jew hatred, like we haven't seen since World War II. Well, you know all about, too, the Muslim immigration into Europe and how that this is fueling more hatred aimed at Jews. In Sweden, there was a report recently that revealed that there's now 61 places in Sweden that are no-go zones. 61 areas where pretty much the radical Islamists have taken over. And so people, even Swedes, just stay away from it. They steer clear of it. Last night during her speech, she talked about what's behind this alarming rise in anti-Semitism. And she outlined three causes in particular. Here's a bit more of what she said. This is clip 4.
There are three different sources of anti-Semitism in Britain and in Europe. There is the anti-Semitism on the left, there is the anti-Semitism on the right, and there is the anti-Semitism in the Muslim community. All these threats to the Jews are connected to each other. All are rooted in turn in broader threats to Britain and to Europe themselves. And all are creating a perfect anti-Jewish storm.
The perfect storm of Jew hatred. It is swirling. You can see it on the horizon. She spent quite a lot of time talking about radical Islam in particular, which is not just a big problem for the Jews. I mean, it's a big problem for Europeans. It's a big problem for the British, as we saw last year with multiple attacks. Same with the United States. Here's a little more of what she said last night, clip 5.
Britain and Europe refuse to acknowledge that the Islamist threat is based upon religious fanaticism, upon an interpretation of Islam which, although it is not supported by many Muslims, and indeed Muslims are the most numerous victims of this particular interpretation of Islam, is nevertheless dominant within the Islamic world. Instead, identifying these threats as rooted in Islam is damned as Islamophobic, and we are not allowed to talk about it. Since any criticism of Islam is deemed Islamophobic, there is, in turn, a refusal to acknowledge the enormous problem of Muslim anti-Semitism. Yet, this is one of the principal drivers of the Islamic threat, not just to Jews, but to the West in general. Islamist ideologues and jihadis believe that modernity is the great threat to Islam. Modernity has to be resisted and destroyed, and that the Jews are the demonic creators of that modernity. Paranoid conspiracy theories and other deranged falsehoods about Jews pour out of the Islamic world in an unstoppable torrent, but it is Islamophobic to talk about it. Opinion polls consistently show that hatred of Jews is far more prevalent amongst Muslims than in the wider community. The Muslim journalist here, Mehdi Hassan, wrote in 2013, quote, "Anti-Semitism isn't just tolerated in some sections of the British Muslim community. It's routine and commonplace. It's our dirty little secret." Close quote. But of course, if you're not Mehdi Hassan, it's Islamophobic to talk about it.
Hassan, see, can talk about it because, well, he's a Muslim journalist. It's common. I mean, it's routine. In the British Muslim community, it's commonplace, Jew hatred, but you can't discuss it. You can't talk about Muslim anti-Semitism because to even bring it up makes you Islamophobic, as she brings out. Now, I was pointing out in class this morning, I mean, obviously the bigger problem here is with man in general, human nature, man's heart. And there's a lot of blame to go around. But with respect to some of these, well, these contributing factors to this perfect storm, I mean, what does it say when you can't even bring it up, when you can't even discuss the problem without making yourself a target, without bringing persecutors against you, calling you a bigot, calling you an Islamophobe? She went on to say in clip six here.
Anyone who actually calls out those threats for what they are is denounced as a bigot. But those who do so, those who damn the people who are trying to draw attention to this threat, themselves are conniving at the perpetration of continuing Muslim Jew hatred.
They're just fueling the hatred by calling out those who are just simply trying to draw attention to the problem or the threat. That made up a pretty big chunk of her presentation last night. She also had a really fascinating section. Again, we've discussed some of this on this program and at the website, just the decline of the Judeo-Christian ethic. But she's a skilled writer and speaker, very logical in the way that she presents her facts. And when she talked about the decline of Christianity in the West, and even the decline of Judaism in the United States, that sickness, that moral sickness, has a lot to do with these other problems that we now see, or the ones that we can't even address, but they're there. They're everywhere. They're all around us. But why is our society, our free society in the United States or in the UK, why are there so many from the left, the radical left? Why are there so many who hate the Jews? or who maybe say, well, I'm not against Jews, but I'm against Israel. I'm against the Israeli state. She made a big point last night saying that it's the same thing. I mean, if you're coming out against the Israeli state the way that you are with this, this, and this, you're attacking Jews, pure and simple. But why is there so much anti-Semitism coming from the left? Here she is, again, tying this together with the downfall of that Judeo-Christian ethic. Here's clip 18.
Without its Christian base, the West is nothing. But Christianity in Britain and Europe lost their way a long time ago. Losing their faith, many Christian churches turned instead to social and political activism, liberation theology, and the radical Marxist analysis of the World Council of Churches. Those progressive churches have denied their Jewish parent, embracing instead their Islamic assassin in the misguided hope of saving their flock. They, these churches, are in the forefront of the charge against Israel. I have to say, some of the most devoted and passionate supporters of Israel are Christians. In fact, they are much more devoted and passionate in their support of Israel than many Jews. Nevertheless, progressive churches are in the forefront of the charge against Israel. And in the process, these churches are destroying themselves and the Christianity they represent. But a society without a religious core rests on sand.
Very similar to what the founders said at the establishment of the United States. If you don't have a religious foundation, I mean, your society rests on sand. There are those, as she brought out in the middle of that clip, coming from probably the evangelical community, who are more devoted in their passion for Israel than even many Jews. But as she said there, the progressive churches are at the forefront. And they have turned to social and political activism. For many of them, that is their religion. Liberation theology. So we're losing it. We're the foundation's crumbling. Someone got up at the end of her presentation during the Q&A and asked her, why are so many Jews in America so liberal? I mean, why do 70% of them vote Democrat? And again, carrying on with this same theme, she said, well, so many of them, they're not very Jewish. That's why. They've become so secular. They're not religious like they used to be. And so they've joined with, as what she said last night, she called it left-wingery, turning instead again to these social and political activist causes. She said last night that they've secularized Judaism. They've hollowed out Jewish values from the Jewish religion. And they think, she's saying this about American Jews, they think they're observing Jewish values by clinging to the Democratic Party. You have some very prominent Jews in the Democratic Party, like Bernie Sanders, and they think they're clinging to Jewish values by embracing these radical leftist principles, these radical leftist ideas. Here's how she described, again, today's society, clip 8.
With no Western nation or Western values thought worthy anymore of defending to the death, wars to establish justice and freedom were replaced by conflict resolution, negotiation, peace processes. Between God and the devil, Western liberals would split the difference and broker a triumphant compromise.
Nothing left to fight for. No values to fight for or to defend to the death if need be. Now it's all about conflict resolution, as she said there, negotiations, peace processes, compromise. These are all contributing factors. It's a perfect storm. back in May of 2009, Brad McDonald had a piece about anti-Semitism at thetrumpet.com. This is about 9 years ago, I guess. Why you should be alarmed. History's repeating itself. Hatred toward Jews. I mean, he said back in the 1930s, hatred toward Jews was politically fashionable. And now you look at Europe today, or Great Britain today. Brad McDonald said in that piece, this is from 2009, during this time, the British government, high society, the intellectual class, and the media, with the exception of a handful of individuals, including Winston Churchill, were infected with animosity for Jews and infatuation with Nazism. If you can believe it, it's not just the young people today. It's not just millennials. I mean, this thinking was there in the 1930s. Even as it was happening, the Holocaust, I mean. You had the newspaper of record like the New York Times. You had the newspaper of record in the U.S. covering it up, basically. Covering up the Holocaust. That's the prestigious New York Times. Mr. McDonald wrote in this piece, similar sentiment prevailed in Europe. It was the same thing in Europe, in Britain. This is in the 1930s. Western leaders during the 1930s were largely blind to the apocalyptic destination of the raging anti-Semitic river. In this sense, the subliminal support given by British, European, and American governments and society to Hitler's anti-Jewish ideology and policies actually made the gas chamber-style anti-Semitism of the 1940s inevitable. We had a hand in it. We cleared the way for it to happen. That's history. That's a valuable lesson to take away from this history if we'd care to wake up and take note. Brad McDonald says here, history's warning is thunderous and undeniable. Pre-World War II trends in Britain, America, and Europe show that anti-Semitism is a barometer of crisis. That's what we want to zero in on here. Where is this leading, this hateful spirit? Where is it leading? We see a lot of the same old demons returning today. The same sins from the 1930s. The lesson is poignant, he says. When nations coddle radical regimes and embrace their genocidal ambitions, they make catastrophic destruction inevitable. See, it's like Melanie Phillips said last night. Instead of fighting to the death for Western values, we've just made a religion out of conflict resolution, negotiation, peace negotiations, compromising with the devil. Well, one final point here before we conclude this segment. This is what she said about Europe. I mean, several people got up during the Q&A and said, look, even looking at the demographics, I mean, this is not, if they keep spilling into Europe through immigration, it's not going in a right direction. So what's going to happen in Europe? Here's clip 20.
Some people think Europe is over, that the demographics are against it, and that it will become a majority Muslim culture in a few decades. Who knows? I don't. My guess, though, is that Europe will not go down without a fight. If that happens, the Jews are likely to get it in the neck from all sides. Whichever way it goes, it's not a pleasant prospect.
That's some pretty good insight there. Of course, we know that Europe is not going to go down with a fight, but she follows that on by saying that whatever way that this goes, the Jews are likely to get it in the neck from all sides. In other words, it's not going to be good for the Jews. Whatever happens, it won't be good for the Jews. And she knows this because of history. She knows this by just simply looking at history. And of course, we know this because of that and Bible prophecy. The Key of David booklet talks about why there's so much Jewish hatred today. And of course, there's other prophecies too that factor in. The double cross, Israel turning to Assyria. Lots and lots of things, of course, to keep our eyes on. Look at that section, though, about why anti-Semitism. It's in the Key of David booklet, my father's Key of David booklet. When we come back, we're going to look at this, too. Just astounding. Going back to the New York Times. And a piece that was written just a few days before the Easter weekend. And it's an outright attack. Not surprisingly, an outright attack against men. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet Daily.
Ahead of the Easter holiday a few weeks ago, Ross Dutat, he's an opinion writer at the New York Times, he took that tradition, that man-made tradition, I might add, and made it an excuse to attack men. He had a column at the New York Times, God and Men and Jordan Peterson. You might remember some clips we've played of Jordan Peterson. He's come under fire for defending the role of the man. That's all. God and men. Dutat at the New York Times said, the men fled, the women stayed. That's the story of Easter weekend in the New Testament. Well, actually, the story of Easter weekend is about bunnies, eggs, and chocolates. That's not in the Bible. But he's taking Easter. He's taking some passages revolving around the crucifixion of Christ and using it as an excuse to attack men of all things. This is where we are today in the Me Too movement. Any excuse there is to attack men, let's go with it. He said here, most of Jesus' male disciples vanished when the trouble started, leaving his mother and Mary Magdalene and other women to watch by the cross, prepare his body for his burial, and then with the men still basically in hiding, find the empty tomb. well, he's factually wrong on multiple levels, but that's to be expected. This is the New York Times commenting on the Bible. But this, like I say, this is the Me Too movement of today. The women are saints and men are villains in every case. And now, I mean, now we're using the Bible, evidently. These organizations, these news companies that have so much hostility and hatred for God and the truth of the Bible, now here's someone bringing the Bible forward and saying that, look, the men fled and the women stayed. It's right there in the Bible. Even the Bible attacks men. Even the Bible exposes all of the flaws of men and praises women. Dutat says here, male absence and female energy has also been the story, albeit less starkly and dramatically, of Christian practice in many times and places since. Well, male authority and leadership is, I mean, it is absent from our society. He's right about that. Does he even know that that's prophesied in the Bible? The very Bible that he's referencing here? It just highlights, as I say, on multiple levels, how little people understand about the Bible. They don't know the Bible. They don't study the Bible. They don't read the Bible. And in this case, they just take a few passages out of context, or they twist it and distort it. And here is the premise of this piece is that this male absence, the men fleeing, this male absence, this is the central lesson of Christ's crucifixion. In fact, male authority and sacrifice and love and commitment and obedience, that is central to the story of Jesus Christ's sacrifice. As it says in the Gospel of John, God the Father, so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, Christ the Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Jesus Christ came to reveal the Father, to declare the Father, John 1, verse 18. He was in the bosom of his Father, as I covered on a program a few weeks back. This is what God's master plan is all about. A family headed up by a father. Regarding that verse, by the way, declaring the Father, my father said in the God Family Vision, that was Christ's message for mankind. It was about the Father. Our Father is the head of that wonderful, majestic God family. He's the head. Our number one passion must be to declare him and his family. If you look again at other passages in the Gospels, Matthew 7, for example, this is just one example of the impact that Jesus Christ's ministry had on the masses. It says, and it came to pass when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. I mean, to be sure, you can find a lot of men in the scriptures with weaknesses. And the same is true with women. As I said in the first segment, the problem is the human heart. And yet look at the agenda of these people. Look at the agenda of those that won't even address a problem for fear of being called a whatever phobe, or the agenda of opinion makers or opinion writers like Ross Dutat, twisting and distorting scriptures so that he can carry out his left-wing agenda. All the men left. All the men fled, and the women had to prepare his body for his burial. And do you know what it actually says in the Bible? Read it in John 19. Read the whole chapter sometime. John 19 and verse 38 says, "And after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, but secretly for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate gave him leave. He came therefore," that's Joseph of Arimathea, "he came and took the body of Jesus." This is after Jesus had been crucified. And Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy disciple of Jesus Christ, he went to Pilate. Mark's version, Mark 15, it says, "Joseph of Arimathea, an honorable counselor, which also waited for the kingdom of God, came and went in boldly unto Pilate, and he craved the body of Jesus." He went in boldly, or with courage. Because there were, these Jews had been whipped up into this mad dog frenzy. They just wanted to crucify him. And so it took some courage on the part of this man. Yes, a man. A courageous man. An honorable man. An honorable counselor. Who went and retrieved the body of Christ so that he could prepare the body for burial. Verse 39 of John 19 says, "And there came also Nicodemus, which at the first came to Jesus by night, and brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, and about a hundred pound weight," it says. So Nicodemus, in John 3, he came by night because he was worried. He was fearful of what persecutors might do to him. But here in John 19, he's more courageous and more bold, just like Joseph of Arimathea. And here are these two men preparing the body of Christ for a proper burial. Verse 40 says, "Then took they the body of Jesus and wound it in linen clothes and with spices in the manner of the Jews, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new sepulcher, wherein was never man yet laid. There laid they Jesus, therefore, because of the Jews' preparation day, for the sepulcher was near at hand." So they took him to this garden tomb to bury him. And they had to hustle. They had to hurry on because the preparation day was at hand. Now, again, getting back to people not just really having much of an understanding of anything in the Bible, even some of the basic details. Many people read this and take it to mean that, it must have been on Friday because the Sabbath was approaching. So you've got Good Friday, and then you try to squeeze in the 3 days and three nights into that weekend, and you have an early Sunday morning resurrection. In fact, that's just a day and a half. You can back up in this same chapter. Look at verse 31. This is John 19. It says, "The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day." And then in parentheses, it says, "For that Sabbath day was an high day." This was a high holy day. This was one of the seven annual festivals, an annual holy day, which on that particular year, in that particular week, it came on a Thursday, and so late Wednesday afternoon, here come these two men, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, to prepare Christ's body for burial. Two men. Ross Dutat says the men fled and the women stayed. What does your Bible say? You look at this same chapter. John 9, this takes us before he was stabbed with the spear. So Christ is on the stake at this point. He's been brutally beaten. He's about to die. He's about to be murdered. Verse 25, it says, "Now there stood by the cross of Jesus, his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. It says, and when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by, whom he loved, this would be John, he said unto his mother, woman, behold your son. And then said he to the disciple, behold your mother. And the scriptures say, this is the Bible, this is the Holy Bible, this is the God-inspired text. It says, and from that hour, the disciple took, that's John, the man, the disciple, he took her, Christ's mother, unto his own house. By this point in the story, Joseph, of course, Mary's husband, he had died. And here is Jesus Christ, while on the stake, after his body had been ripped to shreds, he was concerned about his grief-stricken mother. What a man! What love and sacrifice! What outflowing concern for the good and welfare of others. In this case, his own mother, his older mother, this widow. Joseph, by the way, here again, people don't know the Bible. They don't know this. A lot of it's because of false teachings in traditional Christianity, where Joseph is represented as an uneducated hick. But he married this superior woman, Mary, and then he never could quite understand his son's remarkable genius, Jesus Christ. But just look into the New Testament sometime and see what it says about Joseph, Mary's husband, Jesus Christ's stepdad. The Bible says he was a just man. And early on, I mean, he intended to put away Mary privately after it was discovered that she was pregnant. He didn't want to make a public spectacle of it. He loved her. He didn't want her to be stoned to death for adultery. But then God admonished Joseph. Go ahead and marry her. This is of God, what's happening here. She's still a virgin. This is supernatural, what's taking place here. And so this God-fearing, just man, he married her. He loved God. He loved his wife. He provided for his wife. He provided for his family. He was a successful carpenter. His sons worked along with him. But as I say, by the time you get to John 19, he's no longer in the picture. He had died previous to this. And so Jesus, on the stake, suffering, he looks at his mother and he looks at John and he says to John, you take her in. You take care of my mother. Well, then after that, you can read in verse 34. One of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side, and forthwith came there out blood and water. And so that was the end of his physical life. What a man. It's central to this story. Dutat says, male absence and female energy has also been the story, albeit less starkly and dramatically, of Christian practice in many times and places since. Today, most Christian churches and denominations in America, conservative as well as liberal, male-led and female-led, both, have some sort of gender gap, sometimes modest but often stark, despite their varying theologies. Evangelicalism, mainline Protestantism, Mormonism, and Catholicism all have about 55 to 45 female-male split in religious identification. So 10% more. This is true. He's right on this point. But what about this dearth of male leadership? It's actually prophesied in the very God-inspired book that Dutat uses here, loosely, in order to attack men. We've gone through that prophecy a number of times in Isaiah 3. The Federalist had a piece recently, well, in response to Dutat's article in large part. But it says further on in this piece, referring to de Tott, saying that since he's presumably read the Gospels, then one has to wonder why de Tott rendered the story in this erroneous and stilted way. Why put so much effort into twisting the narrative into such a pretzel just to take a cheap shot at men? Accordingly, it's ironic that immediately after his swipe at men, de Tott goes on to detail men's growing disengagement from various Christian churches. He also observes that other factors like frequency of prayer and belief in God show even deeper differences between men and women. But like this piece brings out at the Federalist, I mean, this trend, this development, it's not limited to religion alone. We see it all over the society we're in. The Federalist says male disengagement spans many different cultural institutions in an increasingly post-Christian West, not just our churches. We've long been observing the same kind of sex gap in higher education. And then it goes on and gives some of the stats. I mean, the academy, it's more hostile toward men than just about any other institution. And religion, too, like this article brings out. American men are failing, like Tucker Carlson brought out on his Fox News series the other month. We played some of those excerpts for you on this program. Isaiah 3. God says he's going to take them away and then give children and women to rule over us. The men aren't ruling. Here they've been attacked. They've been maligned. They've been put down. They've been squashed. And here comes Ross de Tott saying that now that they've gone absent, or they've gone missing. Here he comes with the Bible to explain why. Well, really, that's the story of the Bible, he says. It's astonishing. The Federalist says, well, it talks about religion. You want to get more men into religion? And this is, you know, the Federalist take on it. Stop putting them down. It is interesting. It talks about even in the world of traditional Christianity, this author went through a Google search on Father's Day sermons, and it was amazing. the top sermons that appeared on his search, a lot of them were just put downs of men, you know, jokes about men, quite unlike the most common Mother's Day sermons, where all the women are praised, they're valued. This is in the world of Christianity, traditional Christianity. The Federalist says you get even the same thing in popular Christian movies. Take Mom's Night Out, for example. This is the Federalist. It says even the critic at feminist Dame magazine was upset by how badly the men in the film were portrayed. And then the Federalist says, when even feminists are saying, hey, maybe your portrayal of men is too negative, you know you've got issues. You know you've got issues. And then this, here's the conclusion. God's instructions, this is amazing to me. I mentioned Isaiah 3. He brings up Ephesians 5. God's instructions to husbands and wives in Ephesians 5 is probably the most hated Bible passage in America, without exception, both in church and at seminary. Every time I have heard Ephesians 5 taught, the husbands love your wives part was laid out straightforwardly with a healthy dose of shame for men who do not aspire to love their wives as Christ loves the church. It says this is as it should be. Flattery of men is not the solution here. Nevertheless, when those same teachers taught the part that instructs wives to submit to their husbands as unto Christ, they spent the entire time hedging, explaining nothing while piling up often dubious exceptions until submission had no tangible meaning at all. And that's if they didn't just gloss over it entirely. This is poor instruction, particularly when we consider which part our culture is most apt to rebel against. If we teach the female half of our congregations that God's instruction is to be carefully avoided, the male half is going to learn the same lesson, and they won't be oblivious to the blatant hypocrisy. He says, finally, our churches similarly neglect God's teaching on divorce, to our shame, while conservative Christians will usually stand firm against liberal sins, abortion, homosexuality, and so on. We're less apt to address sins that involve most of the people in our own congregations. Basically, he's saying, we don't believe the Bible. We don't obey the instructions of God. We pick and choose what we want. You can see why religion hasn't solved this problem. This problem of men who've gone missing. There's plenty of strong examples in the Bible, Old Testament and New. There's a perfect example in Jesus Christ. And the Bible, your Bible, says to follow in his steps. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we put the finishing touches on yet another week of broadcasting here on KPCG and KPCG.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.